From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. Coming up, the election is over, but the vote counting continues. Why thousands of ballots from independent voters might be tossed out in Los Angeles.
If they want to exercise that right, in most counties, they have to speak up at the polls and proactively request a partisan ballot. We've put up a lot of hurdles to make it difficult for declined estate voters to cross over.
Also, Hollywood writers are back to work. We'll talk with two of them about what they learned from the strike. And what happens when you cross a one-ton mammal with a speeding car?
Sooner or later, somebody's going to be killed directly by an elephant seal. It will happen someday. You know, there are always people who've got to go press their luck.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Those stories plus Spanish language DJs in L.A., jockey for influence. It's the California Report. A week and a half after the presidential primary, about 800,000 votes are still being counted. A lot of mail-in ballots arrived at the last minute. And there's another snag. In Los Angeles, election officials are figuring out how to count some 50,000 ballots filled out by declined to state or independent voters. As L.A. Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, the so-called double bubble trouble has L.A. election officials scrambling to make sure this never happens again.
To get a sense of how confusing a ballot was for L.A. County declined to state voters, L.A. County Registrar Dean Logan shows me a couple of ballots from last week's election. On the declined to state ballot, there were 10 bubbles to fill in for the presidential race. Bubble 1 listed the Democratic Party. Bubble 2 listed the American Independent Party. Voters had to choose one of these parties to cross over to. 49,500 voters failed to do this. The final 8 bubbles listed candidates.
On the actual ballots, that the 3 candidates for American Independent are all in positions that were also valid positions for Democratic candidates.
So if a voter failed to indicate which party he or she was voting for, it made it more difficult to determine which candidate they had chosen. For example, on the ballot Logan is showing me, the 3rd bubble down is shared by Democratic candidate Barack Obama and American Independent candidate Mad Max Rixey. One might assume that a voter who neglected to fill in the party on a ballot like this was probably voting for Obama instead of Mad Max. Not so fast, cautions Logan.
We cannot just assume voter intent. We have to be able to clearly and with certainty determine voter intent.
Logan's office is trying to find out how many ballots show a clear choice of candidate. That is, a bubble which was filled in that wasn't shared by more than one candidate. After they determine that, though, they still need to see if it's legal to count these ballots. Logan's office is working with California Secretary of State Deborah Bowen to determine just that. Bowen says the goal is to count as many ballots as possible. She says state law gives some leeway to election officials in this situation.
That's a good thing because it really puts the burden on elections officials to do everything that they can to count ballots. Count votes.
In the end, California Democratic Party representatives say a recount won't shift any delegates from one candidate to another. But for L.A. County Registrar Logan, that's not the point.
I understand the emotion around this issue and the frustration about it, but it's also important that we get it right in terms of the next steps that we take and that we make sure that it doesn't happen again.
The L.A. County ballots for the next election in June, he says, will be changed to make sure this doesn't happen again. For the California Report, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
That bubble trouble in Los Angeles highlights a bigger problem. Unless you've registered as a Republican or a Democrat in California, participating in primary elections is tough, if not impossible, for nonpartisan voters.
If they want to exercise that right, in most counties, they have to speak up at the polls and proactively request a partisan ballot. We've put up a lot of hurdles to make it difficult for declined estate voters to cross over.
That's Kim Alexander, president of the California Voter Foundation. She says that if these disenfranchised declined estate voters in Los Angeles were instead, say, Republicans or Democrats, state officials would be much more upset than they are.
There aren't any lawmakers in the Capitol who are necessarily looking out for the interests of declined estate voters. And that's a shame because this is the fastest growing block of voters in California's electorate.
She's got that right. While the major parties have seen their share of the electorate shrink in the past 2 decades, the percent who register with no party has doubled. Now, back to Los Angeles. Part of the problem is the voting equipment there. After the 2000 presidential election, all those hanging chads in Florida prompted Congress to pass a new law helping states replace punch card ballot machines. With some 4 million people registered to vote, L.A. has more voters than any county in the nation. So changing voting equipment is very expensive. Instead of replacing all its old equipment, they just modified it, a temporary fix that declined to state voters are now being punished for. California, with 58 counties, lets local officials decide which equipment to buy, so long as the Secretary of State approves it. Wouldn't it be easier, you might ask, to just have one system for the whole state rather than doing it piecemeal by county? A few states, like Georgia and Oregon, have done that. But that's not practical in California, says Stephen Kaufman, vice chair of the State Voting Modernization Board.
A voting system that's good for the county of Los Angeles may not be a voting system that fits the voters of Yolo County. They are two very different places with two very different needs. And so because of that, we don't have comprehensive voting systems that are in place throughout California.
Steve Weir, president of the California Association of Election Officials, says voting equipment is only part of the problem. After all, if voters had just filled in the right bubbles in Los Angeles, their votes would have counted. And that, says Weir, brings up the issue of human error.
Registrars can make mistakes. Vendors can make mistakes. Poll workers, and you can have upwards of 100,000 of them, can make mistakes. And of course, the voters make mistakes. And they make mistakes on paper ballots. They make mistakes on electronic voting. You're never going to have a perfect election, but it is the goal.
Winston Churchill liked to say that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. Let's see if some of those imperfections can be fixed in time for the presidential election in November. Hollywood writers returned to work this week after a 100-day strike. Members of the Writers Guild of America voted overwhelmingly to end their walkout, and we talked with two of those writers about life back at work. Mark Stegman has written for all 7 seasons of NBC's comedy Scrubs. Corrine Rosenthal writes for the TV series Bones, which airs on Fox. I asked Rosenthal how fast the writers got back to work.
My husband, who is also a writer, the strike ended on Wednesday, and he got a call from an executive that day asking for a rewrite of the first act of his movie the next day.
Wow.
So there's a lot of panic on the studio's side, and that transfers to the writers.
So what have you been doing for the last 100 days besides picketing? Have you been writing at all?
Green?
I have not. I have not, much to my agent's chagrin. He called, I think, a week into the strike and said, so have you started the Great American Novel? You know, and I said, no. And then I was trying to express to him how exhausting a strike is and that it's not a vacation and that picketing takes time and it's also ridiculously physically. We're such wimps, but there's something about walking very slowly in a circle for 3 to 4 hours that creates this thing we're referring to as like museum back, that you're just, your body is just tired. You go home, you take a nap, you have to check all the emails you've gotten for the day about the strike, write emails, make phone calls, etc., and then you just go to sleep and do it all the next day.
Mark, what about you?
Sort of the same story. I the first day of the strike, I remember saying to one of the other Scrubs guys, hey, we'll go early. You know, we'll do that like 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. shift, and then we'll grab some lunch, maybe go play some golf, and then we'll come, you know, then we'll go home and write. We can do that every day for, you know, until the strike ends. It'll be perfect. And I never made it past lunch. It was like as soon as we had lunch that first day, I went home and took like a 4-hour nap. But I have gotten a little bit done here and there. I wrote a little play for my wife's theater company. But other than that, not too much productiveness now.
Do you feel with this pressure now to start being productive, do you feel either writer's block or a fear of writer's block?
Well, yeah, I pretty much always suffer from that. You know, it's what's kept me from writing pilots of my own. And now there's this sort of sense that like, oh, the thing is wide open now. It's like anyone could come in with a great idea and really take it, you know, and it, because they're so desperate for material. And that just seems to be adding another level of pressure to me that I'm not very good at dealing with.
You feel the same way, Corrine?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I'm one of the lucky writers who the strike ended and I immediately went back to a job where I get told what to do.
You don't have to think about it.
So it's much easier to write when that's the case.
Yeah. Now, you write for Bones, which is about a forensic anthropologist who helps law enforcement solve crimes. Where do you get ideas for scripts like that?
Oh, everywhere. I mean, we all do lots of research, just horrific reading about true crimes and things like that. And anything. It doesn't have to have anything to do with a murder or forensic anthropology. It just, if it's something interesting, then it's sort of, oh, maybe this will give us an idea of a milieu in which to set a particular story.
Mark, where do you get your ideas?
Sort of the same. A lot of interviews with doctors and things, and then a lot of sort of revenge taken on bad doctors that we've had to deal with personally or our family members have.
Beware to doctors who may be working with you.
Yeah, exactly.
So many people nowadays are posting their own content on sites like YouTube, and I'm just wondering if you feel like you're competing now with almost everybody who has the ability to upload video.
I think it's a different level and a different approach. You know, the internet is so, I think the term I heard today is snackable. You know, it's like people at lunch are tuning in for 3-minute clips, and that stuff's real funny, but, you know, like you take something like Lazy Sunday or whatever, that really blew up and 100 million people watched it in the first 3 days, but then what? You know, you can't make a series out of those guys rapping around town for 3 minutes every week. So, yes, am I scared that there's sort of a huge amount of talent that's going to just sort of take it on upon themselves to sort of figure out how to do stuff? Yes. I think they're definitely going to be, it's going to come a day when we're competing with all of those people for eyes. But as of right now, I think as huge as the internet is, it still doesn't match TV's sort of collective viewership, you know?
Do you think this strike is going to change the arc of your career at all?
I think it's going to make everything a little harder. You know, I think it's going to make everybody think twice about throwing money around. And I just think nobody really knows. Everyone's a little cautious right now, you know.
I think that's true. And I think that I just want to say, I think we all kind of knew that going in to the strike.
Yeah.
And we would do it again. And that's, I think, the important thing when we got sort of the argument saying, you're being so stupid by going on strike, you're losing viewers to reality and people are going to tune out.
And the money you're asking for is paltry compared to what you'll gain.
Exactly. And the whole point was, yes, the strike is not for me personally. I did lose more money than I will probably get back unless I do create some sort of internet spectacular. But that was it, the point of it was pay forward for the future writers in the same way that those who really fought for us to get pension and health care and things like that did.
Corrine Rosenthal writes for the Fox TV show Bones. Her colleague Mark Stegman has written for all 7 seasons of NBC's comedy show Scrubs. You don't need a Hollywood script for a drama playing out on the Central Coast. The beach near San Simeon is being overrun by thousands of huge elephant seals. These 2,000-pound beasts used to be an endangered species, but not anymore. In fact, there are now so many elephant seals crowding the beach that they're starting to spill out toward the highway nearby. As David Gorin reports, that's creating a problem for drivers and the seals.
There's an amazing sight along a remote stretch of beach north of San Luis Obispo, about 6,000 to 8,000 northern elephant seals jammed onto a narrow strip of sand. These are huge animals, some of them 16 feet long and 5,000 pounds of blubber and muscle. They are packed in here so tightly there isn't an inch between them. And the mass of them stretches on and on along the beach. And these are loud animals. That's not flatulence and belching. That's lovemaking. These elephant seals have migrated all the way from the Gulf of Alaska. They come to this spot every winter to breed and to fight off other elephant seals. And then, says longtime elephant seal observer Lou Tornatsky, to breed some more.
And this is sort of all basic. So you have all the ingredients. There's conflict, there's lust, there's birthing. It's kind of like a Mel Gibson movie without the bad dialogue.
In fact, this chaos is like the elephant seal version of spring break. And just like unruly college kids, these wild animals can get into trouble. Sometimes these elephant seals try to run across the road. Only this road is Highway 1.
It's a real hazard to both wildlife and the people driving.
That's marine biologist Brian Hatfield. He says that even though there have only been a handful of car collisions with elephant seals over the years, the problem is becoming much bigger now. There are so many more seals now, and the fences containing them have begun to fall apart. Last month, Hatfield found himself trying to herd a 1,500-pound seal back across the road. And he found out that you can't really tell an elephant seal where to go.
You could get them to move in the direction you want it to, but then it seems like they make up their own mind.
It took the combined forces of state parks, fish and game, the Marine Mammal Center, and the Highway Patrol to stop traffic for a few hours one morning and shoo the reluctant beast back to the beach. But other incidents have been less controlled. There was the famous night when a family of tourists had their Nissan Pathfinder pulverized. And when the passenger in the car saw this 10-foot-high, 1-ton pile of blubber with large teeth rearing up in the high beams, she thought it was a monster.
I can believe that in the dark. And if you're not somebody who's very familiar with the seals, it would look like a monster, definitely.
Biologist Patricia Morris works with elephant seals farther north, near Santa Cruz. She says that usually elephant seals end up on extremely remote beaches. The San Simeon beaches are the only elephant seal breeding grounds right up against the highway. But it's not just the highway and the occasional one-ton roadkill that Morris is worried about. With so many elephant seals in close proximity to so many people, it's only a matter of time, she says, before something bad happens.
Sooner or later, somebody's going to be killed directly by an elephant seal. It will happen someday. You know, there are always people who've got to go press their luck.
Because resting elephant seals can look so calm and placid lying in the sand, people get really close to them, Morris says. Sometimes people pose their kids near them for photos. They forget they're dealing with wild animals, very large wild animals.
Humans are used to, in our current society, are used to expecting everything to be safe. But we can't go around assuming that our government makes it safe for us to act like fools.
Caltrans is working on making it safer by reinforcing the fences to keep elephant seals away from the highway. And of course, new fences are eventually going to have to be built because as the elephant seal population continues to expand, those seals are moving farther and farther down the coast, possibly to a beach near you. For the California Report, I'm David Gorn in San Simeon.
Bay Area writer Beth Lissick hit the public consciousness and the New York Times bestseller list in 2005 with her memoir, Everybody Into the Pool. Now she brings her distinct wit to the self-help movement. Jordan Rosenfeld has this review.
Beth Lissick gets the idea for her book, Helping Me Help Myself, on a hungover morning after her annual New Year's Eve party. A self-professed skeptic, she's mostly avoided the self-help section. But after another year of struggling financially, which sees her dressing up as a life-size banana for a fruit company and hoping her husband's music career will take off, she says, complaining about how lame you are gets kind of old after 15 or 20 years. Her New Year's resolution is to choose 12 areas of her life to change and a self-help guru for each one. Chapter 1 is titled A Lesson in Cringe Stifling. So from the start, I expected a lot of snarky put-downs and easy jokes. And while the sarcasm is definitely there, I was quickly laughing out loud. She writes, there are supposedly 30,000 certified life coaches in the world right now, which means that each time I say those words with a sneer, I am essentially hawking a giant loogie on a group of people who are only trying to help. Because of her snide sense of humor, I expected Lissick to be resistant to change, but I was instead surprised by her openness. Armed with a razor-sharp lens and an honest desire to grow, she progresses through a series of the most well-known self-help types in the business. From chicken soup for the soul creator, Jack Canfield, she learns to take every opportunity, with some small success. And from management expert Stephen Covey, she accepts that she is responsible for her own life, which makes her feel like an aimless slacker. Organizational guru Julia Morgenstern helps Lissick see how cluttered her life is, to her embarrassment, and money maven Susie Orman inspires the epiphany that she equates being a writer with being broke. It's really only John Gray, author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, who brings back her cringe reflex with his old-fashioned stereotypes and his blatant effort to make money on a new line of herbal supplements. The most side-splitting and strangely touching experience is when Lissick and her friend Jan take the week-long Richard Simmons cruise to lose. First, she's starstruck by the campy exercise guru, and then touched by his sincerity with his guests. but it's his startling humor that takes Lissick and this reader by surprise. She writes, "As Simmons strolls around, he pauses next to me and Jan, leans in between us, and says slyly and only to us, 'Is this the hooker table?' He flips up the flaps of his little shorts, flashing his butt cheeks without turning his head." Helping Me Help Myself is not so much an assessment of self-help as a window into Lissick's soul, a funny, self-deprecating, and yes, skeptical world, but one that sucks you in with its sharp honesty and humor.
Jordan Rosenfeld is a freelance writer in Morgan Hill. She reviewed Helping Me Help Myself by Beth Lissick. L.A.'s top Spanish-language DJs have lots of influence. For example, they mobilized many of the people who took part in recent immigration rights marches. For years, the nationally syndicated El Piolín and El Cucuy have ruled the roost. Now, a third disc jockey, who goes by the name Don Cheto, has moved into the number two spot. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman López reports that listeners don't seem to care that his on-air persona, a country bumpkin delivering homespun tales and wisdom, is a total fabrication.
Like L.A.'s two other top DJs, 27-year-old Juan Raso sneaked illegally into the United States. He was 15. His parents emigrated here from Mexico to repay debts. They told Raso to take a flight from Michoacán to Tijuana. There, he found a smuggler who delivered him east of the city limits.
So we start walking 1 hour, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 hours. After that, by sunset, we got to this little road. So it's like, okay, we're going to... Our car is going to pull over really quick. So you, and you are going inside the car, and you are going in the trunk. So I got to be in the trunk, right?
The Border Patrol caught him the first time, but not the second. Draso joined his parents in El Monte and started working at a warehouse folding and bagging kids' pajamas for $130 a week. He was a C-plus student at South El Monte High School, he says, but he graduated. At about the same time, he caught the radio bug. 105.5 FM, known as Que Buena, had just hired some high-energy DJs.
My role model were these guys from Mexico that came from Mexico to make it big in the United States. It was like Mexican radio, like yeah, we're here, la-la-la-la-la, more like upper.
A friend introduced Draso to one of the station's DJs. For a year, he worked as an unpaid intern, learned to operate the control board, and got an opportunity to say a few things on the air. Draso stumbled onto his current shtick after a DJ asked him if there were any interesting characters in his hometown. Of course, he answered, Don Cheto, a 63-year-old man who'd drive around town with a huge public address system on the roof of his car.
So I started imitating him the way he used to sound, like, Yeah, here. I just want to remind you, everybody, that here at Juan's house, they're having pork today. Little piece of meat, that's good for the body.
That character became so popular that station managers gave Raso an hour, then two, then earlier this year, his own six-hour show in morning drive time.
So while Don Cheto basically is a grandpa, he's a grandfather for a lot of the immigrants or the guys that are born here in the United States, you know?
Agarraron 19 toneladas de productos piratas, ¿dónde creen?
Back in the day in Michoacán, where I'm from, we talk instead of saying siete, which is seven, siete, we said siete. We put the E at the end, siete. So he started talking like that, like grandpa style, like really, really old hillbilly, you know?
Saluda Jean-Claude Ramos, Saludoski Jr., mi compañera aquí presente, Godofreda.
Everything Don Cheto talks about is because he knows. I mean, I went through that. I went through not having money for the rent or have to ask for a ride or not having money for the gas or have a messed up car.
Draso's co-host, Marlene Quinto, more or less plays herself. A 20-something Mexican-American with one foot in American culture and the other on the run from her Mexican roots. Don Cheto and Marlene debate music, fashion, boyfriends, and language. One teaches the other.
Esto fue Notiche, segunda edición, segunda parte. Noticieros hay muchos. Pero Notiche, compañera, ¿garabais?
¡No la pena! Bueno, pues yo recomiendo el programa cuando...
Carson resident Patricia Ortega listens with her husband and four teenage girls. The radio is on from 5 to 11 as she's helping the family get out the door. She says Don Cheto is entertaining and wholesome enough to have on around the girls. It's a highly polished formula that's tripled the station's 18 to 34-year-old Spanish-speaking audience in its time slot. That's a gold mine for the station's ad reps. Don Cheto has displaced longtime favorite El Cucuy from the number two spot in L.A. Spanish language radio. And Juan Raso has straightened out his immigration status. He says Don Cheto's make-believe persona has allowed him to rise from living in a garage to parking a Lincoln Navigator in the garage at his four-bedroom house in Newhall. Raso's parents and two sisters returned to their Mexican hometown about a year ago after he built them a house there. He loves visiting them.
I mean, I could easily go today to Mexico and live the rest of my life there, leaving everything behind. I'm really serious. I could leave the radio and my paycheck and my truck and the house. I could go back.
The town reminds him of the one in his favorite novel, the Latin American epic 100 Years of Solitude, with its small-town characters whose stories are larger than life. For the California Report, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez in Los Angeles.
And that's our little show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer with engineering help from Tom Krimkowski. Our online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are June Stinson, Ali Tabatabai, and Leanne Lucetta. Victoria Maleon is our producer. Ingrid Becker is the senior producer. Our news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Hope you have an awesome weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California. The California Teachers Association, because every child deserves a chance to learn and no child succeeds alone. More information is available at cta.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.